ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hey, Natasha Mitchell, inviting you, if you're in Victoria, to join me on Wednesday night, the 19th of November, at the Fitzroy Town Hall in Melbourne for a live event with Astrid Jorgensen. Now, she created that joyous collective singing event called Pub Choir. Her new memoir, Average at Best, is this wonderful read all about embracing mediocrity if you want to get anything done, and a whole lot more. Head to the Big Ideas homepage and just look for Be In Our Audience down the bottom for details of that. Now, up ahead, Harvard, MIT, Yale, Stanford, Columbia. Yes, the United States is famous for its world-leading universities, but in the face of research funding cuts, of government attacks on free speech, on diversity programs, on the right to protest on campus, and the persecution of foreign students, could all that be changing? That's today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas.
Policies won't, to coin a phrase, make America great again, but they may reduce its already great universities to mediocrity and lead to a brain drain. And the cerebral trickle has already begun. It's not just suspiciously progressive scholars of fascism or gender studies who are fleeing. A March 2025 poll of 1,600 scientists in the journal Nature found that 75% were now looking to exit the United States and were actively seeking academic jobs overseas.
Our big thinker today is Dr. Simon Adams. He heads up the New York-based Center for Victims of Torture. And in various roles, including with the United Nations, he's led advocacy to end crimes against humanity, war crimes and genocide. And he's been a peacekeeper in Northern Ireland and East Timor. He's also held senior roles in Australian universities. And he's about to return to Australia as a professor of human rights at Murdoch University. And today on Big Ideas, he's making a strong case for universities as an antidote to authoritarianism, not just in the US, but around the world. And he's joining you from Gadigal Country in Sydney at the 2025 Conference of the Australasian Council of Deans of Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities.
Thanks. It's great to be here. It's a great honour to be with you all. But the nervous kind of undergraduate student that still lurks within me is gripping this lectern with a little tiny bit of trepidation. You know, over the course of my career as a human rights defender, I've been arrested and on a few, thankfully rare, occasions even had people threaten to shoot me. But this is a truly intimidating assembly here this morning. So, from the roof of my apartment building in Brooklyn, you can see the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. And admittedly, she's a fair distance away, but it is unmistakably her in all her sort of oxidized glory. And at night, she is lit up and luminescent. And gazing at the glittering Manhattan skyscrapers that are just across from her, one is, of course, reminded of the immigrant generations who first entered that harbor by ship, passing by the Statue of Liberty on their way to disembarkation at Ellis Island. And the ships didn't pass quite close enough to read Emma Lazarus's poem, which is engraved on the pedestal with its call to give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. But that message has become arguably almost as iconic as the statue. It is, arguably, America's second most famous declaration to the world. And I'm an immigrant myself, as was mentioned. You know, I've been living and working in the United States for the past 14 years. But recent political developments in America have caused me to retreat to that Brooklyn rooftop, probably more often than normal, seeking solace in that view of the Statue of Liberty. It's also sort of driven me to re-examine some of my favorite writings from the 20th century's most famous literary opponent of authoritarianism, George Orwell. In 1940, George Orwell lifted his portentous pen to review Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. And in just a few serrated lines, Orwell expressed several truths regarding the threat that a joyless and malevolent narcissist like Hitler posed to democracy. The first was that Hitler always spoke and wrote in a way that if he were killing a mouse, he would know how to make it seem like a dragon. Hitler invariably presented himself and his supporters as victims, always battling iniquitous enemies and suffering under intolerable wrongs. Remind you of anybody? Ring a bell. The second observation was that there will always be a certain constituency of voters in democratic countries who desire not just comfort and security, but also drums, flags, and loyalty parades. And in the midst of the Great Depression, of course, Hitler promised such people both economic salvation and also paramilitary pageantry. And as a result, a whole nation, in Orwell's words, flings itself at his feet. And Orwell was, of course, no casual commentator on these matters. He had fought in Spain's Civil War, where he was shot by a fascist sniper. He had also survived World War II. And a few years later, he wrote 1984, exposing us to the imaginary world of Big Brother. And in the real world at that time, there were less than 30 democracies across the globe. Dictatorships, fading autocracies, and colonial powers still ruled over most of the world's population. Millions of people went to sleep at night, fearing their secret police's own version of Room 101. Nevertheless, in 1948, the year before Orwell's dystopian masterpiece was published, a majority of states at the fledgling United Nations voted to adopt the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Despite the Cold War, the following decade saw the uneven but incremental advancement of human rights norms and laws. And Orwell's place in the pantheon of political literature also became secure as the century progressed. Orwellian became a pejorative term, deployed to denounce acts of institutional cruelty, sinister surveillance, and thought control. And in the real life year of 1984, appropriately enough, the UN adopted the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. And this was a historic achievement that made torture illegal everywhere at all times and under all circumstances, no exceptions. It also led, incidentally, to the formation of my current organization, the Center for Victims of Torture, which has grown, as was mentioned, to become the largest torture rehabilitation organization in the world. The period from 1989 then to around 2000, the early 2000s, if you like, saw a significant expansion in the number of democracies worldwide and a corresponding increase in free speech and civil liberties. This is part of what is referred to as the third wave of democracy by people like Samuel P. Huntington. According to Freedom House, in 1989, before the fall of the Berlin Wall, there were 76 democracies in the world. By 2000, this had increased to 120 democracies, about 63% of all UN member states. And during this period, of course, most of Eastern Europe transitioned from Stalinist regimes to multi-party democracies. And various military-dominated states that were aligned with the West during the Cold War also transitioned to democratic rule. These changes, which were kind of amplified by the digital revolution in technology, helped expand free speech and access to information. So this was our sort of imperfect world at our fin de siècle. It was the end of a half century when human beings had made remarkable scientific and technological progress. We created the internet. We built skyscrapers. We eradicated smallpox and learned how to transplant hearts. We sent monkeys and Americans into space. By the start of the new millennium, despite sort of enduring inequities, there was a precipitous global decline in the number of refugees, armed conflicts, and dictatorships. There was also increased adherence to the international conventions, laws, and norms that safeguard humanity. That includes the principle of the responsibility to protect populations from war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. That norm, which is often referred to as R2P, is an international norm, as was mentioned, popularized by former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and Australia's former Foreign Minister Gareth Evans. And I was originally brought to New York to advance R2P with the UN Security Council. But 2 decades later, we are now in the midst of a great unraveling. You know, I was reminded of Orwell's 2 insights in January this year when another malignant narcissist, US President Donald J. Trump, was inaugurated for a second time and promptly issued numerous executive orders that sort of constituted his MAGA declaration to the world. These include a policy of mass deportation of 11 million undocumented migrants from the United States, including, it must be said, also deporting some unwanted legal migrants, imposing a halt on refugee resettlement, except for a few dozen white Afrikaners from South Africa, and terminating foreign aid programs, including to torture survivors, forcing my own organization to halt 75% of our services on 3 continents and to furlough 420 staff. And so through all of this, Trump wants to convince people that he's fighting dragons, and he is doing no such thing. These are policies of performative cruelty. But the damage is egregious. Or as Betsy Reid, the editor of The Guardian, summarized on the 18th of June, and I quote, "When elected officials of the opposing party are arrested or handcuffed, when the military is deployed to quell overwhelmingly peaceful protests, when student activists are jailed and deported, and when a wide range of civic institutions are targeted and penalized by the federal government, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that our core freedoms are disappearing before our eyes, and that democracy itself is slipping away." What is absolutely unconscionable is that Trump is doing all of this at a time when, according to the United Nations, there are currently 123 million people in the world currently displaced by persecution, conflict, and atrocities. What that means is that 1 in every 67 people on this planet has been forcibly displaced, with the greatest number being people from Sudan, Syria, Myanmar, Venezuela, Afghanistan, and Ukraine. Because of my work, I meet these people in refugee camps and in our clinics. I see their tears. I witness the human consequences of this new age of impunity, indifference, and inaction. Global displacement is currently at its highest level since the Second World War. That's an index of human misery that has more than doubled in the past decade. And instead of helping to develop solutions to this crisis, President Trump is exacerbating it. Consider the case of the U.S. Agency for International Development, commonly referred to as USAID or USAID, through which about half of all U.S. foreign aid was previously dispersed. In the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, I think, perfectly articulated the essence of the defunding of USAID and its gleeful destruction by Trump and Elon Musk. In his 8th of February column, Kristof described this as the world's richest men taking on the world's poorest children. Because the consequences of these actions were extreme. In March, A preliminary study published in the respected scientific journal Nature by a group of nutrition experts attempted to quantify the effects of the Trump administration's devastating cuts to international food aid. This is how it was reported in DevEx, and I quote, "Their conclusions were sobering. They found that the dismantling of USAID, along with aid cuts by other Western donors, were equivalent to 44% of the $1.6 billion in global donor aid for nutrition provided in 2022. The estimated funding reductions will cut treatment for 2.3 million children in low and middle income countries, leading to 369,000 additional child deaths per year. More than 163,000 of those deaths will be linked to US aid reductions alone." Now, to be fair, those are just initial estimates, but the numbers do not represent a verified body count. But they provide, I think, a disturbing rejoinder to Elon Musk's 3 February tweet, where he bragged that, and I quote, "We spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper. Could have gone to some great parties, did that instead." And so for this reason, and many others, I believe President Trump and his accomplices pose a perilous threat to American democracy and the very idea of humanitarian service. But he is not alone in his authoritarian ambitions. Internationally, a new style of authoritarianism already holds state power in Russia, Turkey, Hungary, Nicaragua, Tunisia, and even in tiny El Salvador, where President Nayib Bukele has described himself as the coolest dictator in the world. These are countries where elections are still held, but they are far from being open, free, or fair. In this era of global disruption, the new authoritarians generally wear business suits rather than military fatigues. But make no mistake, these are places where human rights activists and civil society face existential threats. And European imitators abound in Austria, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Poland. The fanatical far-right fringes of politics have clawed and crawled back into the parliamentary mainstream, using populist, anti-establishment rhetoric to promote toxic xenophobia and hostility to the very idea of building culturally diverse societies. Some of these parties also long for the day when they too can hollow out democracy and dismantle the rule of law. Freedom House's 2025 report documented the consequences of this democratic backsliding. 2024 marked the 19th consecutive year of a global decline in political rights and civil liberties. During the year, 60 countries experienced overall score declines, with only 34 registering improvements. Attacks on media freedom, including censorship, violence, and legal prosecution, were recorded in over 120 countries in 2024. Freedom House also highlighted a growth industry, that growth industry being transnational repression, where authoritarian governments target dissidents abroad. And over the past decade, 48 governments carried out 1,219 attacks against exiled opponents in 103 countries.
Are we witnessing the great unravelling of decades of progress? On Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app, this is Dr. Simon Adams. He is President and CEO of the New York-based not-for-profit Centre for Victims of Torture. Simon was a keynote speaker at the annual conference for the Australasian Council of Deans of Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities, or DASH. So what does all this have to do with universities?
In some countries, a war on universities and free thought is also underway. In this new age of authoritarianism, Hungary has become a cautionary tale, a country where academic institutions were not crushed by tanks, but slowly weakened and captured. After returning to power in 2010, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban started to systematically dismantle academic freedom. Now, this project took some time to achieve its goals, but by 2018, the Central University, Central European University, CEU, founded by the American boogeyman philanthropist who haunts the dreams of the global far right, George Soros, was finally forced out of Hungary when the government passed legislation targeting the university. Michael Ignatieff, the president of CEU, called it a dark day for freedom in Hungary, noting that the university had become a symbol of independent thought in a country increasingly defined by authoritarianism. And what began with CEU expanded to attacks on all Hungarian universities. Orban has repeatedly denounced universities as a breeding ground for liberal ideology and foreign influence, his words. He sees himself as defending Hungary's national sovereignty from these noxious contaminants, especially those that come in rainbow colours. On the latter point, Orban is strangely obsessed with LGBT plus people, even banning the Budapest Pride Parade this past year. In his words, we are replacing liberal democracy with a democracy that is Christian, national, and based on traditional values. As a result, the Orban government has banned gender studies programs from Hungarian universities. And in 2021, the parliament actually passed legislation transferring control of public universities to government-aligned foundations, controlled largely by Orban loyalists. This basically effectively privatized university governance, giving the ruling party a dominating influence over curriculum, hiring, and research funding. Now, the European Parliament criticized this as a profound violation of academic freedom. But Orban's assault is part of a sort of a broader trend whereby authoritarian leaders seek to neutralize universities as spaces for potential disobedience. Their goal is to return universities to being carefully curated intellectual environments that adhere to their narrow worldview. For example, President Trump has denounced American schools and universities as fortresses of woke ideology and transgender indoctrination. In Arizona in July 2022, he said, "Our children are captives to unhinged Marxist educators. We will save our children from this poisonous rot." At a political rally in 2023, he described America's universities as being dominated by Marxist maniacs and lunatics. In November that same year, he accused some university lecturers of turning our students into communists and terrorist sympathizers. He called for a new online American academy to be created instead with, quote, no wokeness or jihadism allowed. Now, at this point, it feels incumbent upon me to also mention that in 2010, the imaginatively named Trump University was forced to shut down after multiple legal complaints alleging that it was a scam and a fraud. And in 2016, Trump was actually forced to pay $25 million in a settlement with disgruntled former students. But Trump is not alone in his animus for higher education. Charlie Kirk, the MAGA provocateur who was recently and regretfully assassinated on a university campus in Utah, wrote two books called The Campus Battlefield and The College Scam. Kirk's Turning Point USA movement has a notorious professor watch list that identifies university lecturers who are insufficiently patriotic, including those who teach critical race theory in their classes or are just considered too woke. And this has led to the sustained harassment of academics like Stacey Patton, an African-American college professor who spoke out against the death threats, threats of sexual violence, racial abuse, and demands for her to be silenced and fired after she was named on that list. And I want to be 100% clear on this point. Kirk did not deserve the horrible public death that he received. But academics like Patton and hundreds of others also don't deserve to be systematically harassed and threatened on dubious ideological grounds. What about some of the others? Before he became Vice President of the United States in November 2021, J.D. Vance gave a speech which kind of gave the game away, entitled "The Universities Are the Enemy." Despite the fact that he himself is a graduate of one of the most exclusive educational institutions in America, Yale University, he told a crowd at a conservative conference in Florida that if any of us wants to do the things we want to do, we have to honestly and aggressively attack the universities. That's a direct quote. So this kind of language about enemies, battlefields, and poisonous ideas isn't just Twitter trolling or campaign hyperbole. Since Trump's inauguration, it's been matched by policies aimed at systematically eroding university autonomy. Trump appears to have a particular obsession with Harvard. And in case you've never heard of it, Harvard is a university that rests along a kind of a gentle curve in the Charles River in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's ranked, depending on what system you prefer, somewhere between second and fourth position in the world. This is partly due to the fact that 52 Harvard faculty members have won Nobel Prizes. This includes prizes in physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, peace, and economics. Harvard has also produced 8 US presidents and 20 other heads of state or government around the world. It has quaint courtyards and ivy-covered faculty buildings. I was there briefly. Nice place. On social media, however, Trump described Harvard, and this is again a direct quote, as a place full of almost all woke, radical left idiots and bird brains who are capable of teaching failure, who are only capable of teaching failure, all caps, to students and so-called future leaders. Please keep in mind, these comments came from a man who, during a joint address to Congress on the 4th of March, claimed that the National Institutes of Health, NIH, spent $8 million making mice transgender. Now, for Trump and his supporters, this was an example of woke science, real phrase, by the way, an obscene waste of US taxpayers' dollars. But the fact is, the NIH never funded experiments to create transgender mice. In reality, the grants Trump referenced had funded 6 studies exploring hormone therapies in mice to understand effects relevant to cancer, asthma, vaccine response, and fertility. But the key point here, the key point, was that Trump confused transgenic mice, that is to say, mice that have had foreign DNA inserted into their genome for the purposes of medical research, and transgender mice, that is to say, mice that apparently use they-them pronouns. So if the consequences weren't so grave, it would be easy to just dismiss this and laugh it off. But this is the president of the United States of America. And because he convinced himself that this potentially life-saving medical research involved little rainbow flag-waving transgender mice, he defunded it. So it's not just banal and stupid, it's scientifically dangerous. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Trump was inaugurated in January. In March, Columbia University had $400 million in federal research grants frozen. Then Harvard lost $2.6 billion in federal research grants for everything from artificial intelligence to medical research on Alzheimer's disease. When the presidents of Princeton and Cornell criticized this, with the former accurately describing it as the biggest assault on university freedom since the Red Scare and McCarthyism, both of those universities then had hundreds of millions of dollars in federal grants and contracts canceled or frozen. You know, not even bothering to disguise the bribe or sugarcoat the shakedown. Trump said that the universities could have their federal funding back if they publicly disavowed past DEI policies, paid massive fines for allegedly allowing anti-Semitism to flourish on campus, and gave the government increased control over such things as foreign student admissions. Columbia was also required to place its entire Middle Eastern Studies department under academic receivership. Now, the size of the fines were reportedly arbitrarily decided by Trump himself, based on how wealthy he thought the universities were. So Columbia was fined $220 million. Harvard has not yet reached a settlement, but it's been told it has to pay the Trump administration $500 million. And the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, took the hardest hit of all. It was told it had to pay $1 billion if it wanted $584 million in federal research funding restored. By the way, Trump also ordered all university presidents had to wear a red MAGA hat at all future faculty meetings. No, I made that bit up. That's 100% fake news. But I bet he wanted to. So this is not just an unconscionable abuse of governmental power. It's extortion, plain and simple. And they are just getting started. According to reporting from March, there were 52 major colleges and universities listed for investigation and corrective action by the Trump administration. And universities and colleges are also taking drastic preventive action to try to avoid being held to ransom. For example, in a recent industry report by the Chronicle of Higher Education, it was revealed that more than 300 campuses have already dismantled DEI programs and policies since President Trump was inaugurated. In the long term, sort of blackmailing and defunding Harvard, Columbia, UCLA, or the National Institutes for Health will decrease the ability of the United States to be a global leader in research and innovation. It'll make America less attractive to the most talented foreign students and the most highly skilled and ambitious migrants. And in that context, it's worth keeping in mind that according to The Economist, more than half of America's billion-dollar startups were founded by at least one immigrant, and a quarter have a founder who arrived as a student. So these policies won't, to coin a phrase, make America great again, but they may reduce its already great universities to mediocrity and lead to a brain drain. And the cerebral trickle has already begun. It's not just suspiciously progressive scholars of fascism or gender studies who are fleeing. A March 2025 poll of 1,600 scientists in the journal Nature found that 75% were now looking to exit the United States and were actively seeking academic jobs overseas. So this trend was especially pronounced amongst early career researchers. And I suspect that unless things change, this trickle may yet become a flood. And there's a real lesson here. The slide towards authoritarianism begins with a war on truth, on knowledge, complexity, on nuance. Because as historian Timothy Snyder, the author of On Tyranny, warns, in a particularly Orwellian turn of phrase, and I quote, "To abandon facts is to abandon freedom." Trump pretends that his attack on American universities is all about DEI, anti-Semitism, and free speech for conservative voices. But that's just political camouflage. This is clearly not about pronoun preferences. And the claim about battling anti-Semitism is patently disingenuous, given Trump's embrace of MAGA-aligned, unvarnished, and unapologetic white supremacists. And it's clearly not about freedom of thought and ending cancel culture when they are also trying to deport a foreign student simply for the thought crime of publishing a pro-Palestinian op-ed in her college newspaper. Here I'm referring to a Turkish doctoral student at Tufts University, Rumeysa Öztürk, who had a student visa revoked, was arrested and abducted off the street by ICE agents, then spent 6 weeks in detention before a federal judge ordered her to be released. This is about power, and that's why universities are a target. And at the heart of that target, the sort of big red bullseye at the dead center, are the arts, social sciences, and humanities.
And Simon Adams is speaking to a room full of deans in the social sciences and humanities at Australian and New Zealand universities. This is Big Ideas, your live event show, right here on ABC Radio National with me, Natasha Mitchell. Find us also on the ABC Listen app. Simon is an Australian. He's based in the US. He's been heading up the Centre for Victims of Torture for the past few years, and this is his rallying cry to defend universities in the face of authoritarian attacks.
Even here in Australia, there's sometimes an attempt to pit the arts, social sciences, and humanities against other supposedly more valid and vital parts of the university sector. For example, through no fault of my own, in preparation for this keynote, I was reading the Australian Higher Education section. And presenting a false dichotomy, in his column of the 16th of July, Stephen Matchett ridiculed the argument that funding research in ancient history might be in the national interest. To quote him, "This will make sense to historians and the plenty of people who love history podcasts, but perhaps not to those who would prefer more research money be spent on climate change or cancer cures." Maybe. But most people are also generally sceptical of the idea that a newspaper owned by a cantankerous geriatric billionaire and his bickering progeny benefits the national interest. And to be clear, the real choice is not between government funding for cancer research versus funding research into ancient history. Anyone with an understanding of universities knows that the connections between researchers from all kinds of disparate academic areas can be combustible. Academics working in the arts, humanities, and social sciences have helped scientists, for example, take crucial steps of imagination, experimentation, and development. Consider the field of bioethics. As gene editing using CRISPR has become more common, ethicists, philosophers, and legal scholars have played a crucial role in defining what these new tools should and should not be used for, resulting in the banning of germline editing in most countries. This prevented so-called designer babies via gene editing of sperm, eggs, and embryos in ways that are heritable. It also ensured broader societal debate about advances in biotechnology. For our mutual edification, let's also quickly contemplate the impact that the arts, humanities, and social sciences have had on computer science. This is reductive, but I'll be quick. Let's go. Our first quick example concerns the fusion of technology and the fine arts when, in 1972, an individual called Steve Jobs took a calligraphy class at Reed College in Oregon before dropping out to found a company called Apple Computers. Jobs later credited his fine arts and humanities experience as the reason why Apple computers had elegant fonts. And what set Apple's first computers apart from their competitors and enabled it to, as Jobs said, put a dent in the universe? In Jobs' own words, it was the first computer with beautiful typography. And the impact was profound. The Macintosh set a new standard and helped shift personal computing towards design-centered innovation. Similarly, staff at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center used psychological studies of cognition, perception, and memory to inform the first WIMP interfaces. That stands for Windows, Icons, Menus, Pointer, and Yes. Making the acronym spell WIMP also represented the peak of 1970s computer nerd humor. Sociologists then helped Xerox assess how users interacted with these systems. This led to the development of intuitive graphical user interfaces and desktops now used in all laptop computers and all smartphones. But Simon, I hear you imploring, what about artificial intelligence? You haven't said a word about AI. We can't have any kind of public meeting without discussing AI in some form. Well, in the same way that Alan Turing's philosophical work on thinking machines laid the groundwork for computer science, Isaac Asimov's science fiction, especially his three laws of robotics, shaped early AI ethics. Then add to this Noam Chomsky's theories on generative grammar and their significant influence on early natural language processing algorithms in computers. Combined together, these initiatives helped enable us to build machines capable of generating human language, leading to the rise of chatbots and translation tools. So today's artificial intelligence, including transformers and large language models, rely heavily on semantic theory, logic, and syntax. And so, without the arts, humanities, and social sciences, there is no ChatGPT, or even that nice digital lady that gave me directions on Google Maps to get up here. Now, those are just a few examples that I've chosen, mainly because they very conveniently suit my argument. But they concern academic areas that, like the study of ancient history, don't necessarily stand out as being key to the national interest, unless you think calligraphy is. The fact of the matter is that Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific will face significant challenges over the next decade, including technological disruption caused by AI, climate adaptation, geopolitical shifts in power, and the growing threat of open conflict between China and the United States. These challenges cannot be overcome by technological solutions alone. Investing in the arts, humanities, and social sciences means investing in a country's social intelligence and enhancing its civic resilience. These disciplines not only contribute meaningfully to the economy, they're crucial to the survival of its democracy. Because what the world desperately needs are more people with omnivorous intellectual appetites, not just technical skills and diminishing attention spans. But let's get back to our regularly scheduled program and the issue of why and how authoritarians like Trump or Orban hate people like you. We're living in an era of impunity and indifference to the suffering of others, a new age of authoritarianism, where performative cruelty has become government policy in far too many countries. We are also engaged in a historic battle of ideas, and the stakes for all of us are enormous. Some historical perspective, I think, is crucial. Every aspiring dictatorship demands loyalty from academia. The Nazis, notoriously, purged the universities and forced Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, Sigmund Freud, and approximately 2,500 other German-speaking academics and public intellectuals to flee overseas. Many others were sent to the concentration camps. Entire academic disciplines were also declared to be degenerate by the Nazis and were abolished, including sociology, psychoanalysis, abstract mathematics, and theoretical physics. But the same pattern of repression and erasure is also true of Pinochet's Chile, Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, Russia under Putin, Maduro's Venezuela, Ortega's Nicaragua, or Myanmar under the rule of the generals. In each of these examples, faculties of arts, humanities, and social sciences became targets. Because in times of darkness and creeping authoritarianism, the arts, humanities, and social sciences compel us to examine the human condition and to understand how culture and power operate in society. They demand that we grapple with uncomfortable facts and consider potentially disruptive ideas. They require us to collaborate and to challenge one another. They enable us to unleash our imaginative and intellectual potential, to investigate, to debate, to create, and to engage in that most subversive human activity of all, critical thinking. And that is threatening, deeply and profoundly threatening to those who are uncomfortable with questioning minds. And these days, that is what I think about when I stand on my Brooklyn rooftop at night, staring at New York Harbor. I wonder to myself, what poems would Emma Lazarus compose today about people yearning to breathe free? What would she make of masked ICE agents forcibly abducting immigrants off the streets of American cities. What would Hannah Arendt think about soldiers being deployed to the streets of Washington, D.C. to clean it up? What would George Orwell say about alligator Alcatraz? And what would they expect of us? You know, now is not a time for despair. And in my few remaining minutes, I'll tell you why. Because of my job, I get to travel the world and I see resilience and hope everywhere, even in the most remote refugee camps, even amongst those who have survived war, torture, and other unimaginable cruelties. Nevertheless, National Public Radio in the United States, NPR, recently reported comments by renowned political scientist Thomas Weiss that many NGOs in the United States are falling into the classic authoritarian trap of anticipatory silence. In other words, trying to be compliant and not provoke the Trump administration as it dismembers civil society and the rule of law. In that story, NPR noted that my organization, the Center for Victims of Torture, stands out for its willingness to resist this trend by consistently publicly speaking up for our clients, torture survivors and other traumatized refugees, and for the humanitarian sector. CBT is also suing the Trump administration in a case that has now traveled all the way to the US Supreme Court and is currently with the US Supreme Court. Despite the funding cuts, we will not be silenced, though I may get deported. Let's see. The day before I got on a plane to fly here to Australia, CBT was also presented with the 2025 Freedom from Fear Award by the Roosevelt Institute in New York, and I was proud to accept that award on behalf of all our staff around the world. But before CBT, as was mentioned in the introduction, for 10 years, from 2011 to 2021, I was the executive director of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, and I worked doing high-level advocacy with the UN Security Council around conflict and atrocities in the world. And for reasons that are probably fairly obvious, because of this work, I spent a lot of time visiting mass graves and talking to survivors. And I became obsessed with the idea of upstanders. And let me explain that. In her 2002 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, Samantha Power wrote about the period since the Holocaust and how we have the means to make never again more than an empty promise. And despite this reality, Power contends that over the second half of the 20th century, when the United States and other countries were confronted by genocide in Rwanda, Bosnia, Cambodia, or Iraq, it's the default setting, particularly in the United States, was to embark upon a resolute policy of inaction. Even when practical humanitarian policy options were readily available, the leaders of the most powerful state on earth chose to be bystanders instead. But she felt that there was an obvious antidote. Power commented that while promoting that book, A Problem from Hell, and I quote her, "Somewhere along the way, I began describing the book's protagonists, those who tried to prevent or otherwise stand up against genocide as upstanders, contrasting them with bystanders." And her message wasn't just aimed at government bureaucrats around the world or people involved in international diplomacy. Rather, in her own words, every day, almost all of us find ourselves weighing up whether we can or should do something to help others. We decide on issues large and small whether we will be bystanders or upstanders. So 23 years later, Power's word, upstander, is more prevalent than ever. Academics write about it. There are numerous books aimed at elementary school students available for order on Amazon, including my personal favorite, Stand Up to Bullying, Upstanders to the Rescue, suitable for ages 8 years and up. In 2021, my daughter Siobhan's middle school in Brooklyn even offered a workshop for parents on raising upstanders. While the focus was to teach families about bullying in school, students were also asked to contemplate what it means to live in a society where blockbuster movies are made about Marvel superheroes, but everyday acts of human decency and civic courage are neglected. So, in order to sate this obsession, I started working on a book. If there's any publishers, please see me after in the coffee break. And interviewing friends and real-life upstanders who I knew from my work, like Noura El-Jazawi, a young Syrian master's student who in 2011 was studying animal symbolism in Arabic literature at Homs University and became one of the very first women to speak at a mass protest against the Assad dictatorship. She was later arrested, tortured, but eventually escaped the country. She now lives in Canada and works for Citizen Lab, exploring the connection between digital communication technologies, human rights, and global security. Or Jo Mo Tun, Myanmar's ambassador to the United Nations, who risked everything, including his career and literally his life, just to stand up in the UN General Assembly and publicly denounce the February 2021 military coup in his country. Or the Attorney General of the Gambia, Abubakar Ba Tambadou, from the smallest country in Africa, who decided one day to take Myanmar to the International Court of Justice for perpetrating genocide against the Rohingya, making legal history in the process. And that's a case and a cause that I was honored to assist with. Now, there are many more extraordinary examples. They're everywhere. These people show us that courage can be contagious, that ideas around human rights, international justice, and humanitarianism can be contagious. They teach us that when it matters the most, we all have the potential to steady our trembling hands, raise our faltering voice, and stand up. So this is my plea to all of you, including all the assembled deans of arts, social sciences, and the humanities from across Australasia and the Pacific, and to all of you who work in the university sector. Be an upstander for your faculty, for your academic disciplines, for your embattled and quite often besieged colleagues around the world, and for your students. Because make no mistake, in these troubling times, what you think and do matters. It matters. And those of us who are outside the university sector are looking to you, because democracy does not always expire with a single event, like a military coup. Sometimes it just kind of slides slowly into the darkness, corroding norms and corrupting independent modes of thought along the way. You wake up one day and realize that even though your society looks the same from the outside, in that the institutions and its outward democratic form remain intact, it has been hollowed out and that the gates to the university are now locked. So, one final thought, quickly if I may. One of the more reputable parts of my otherwise dubious biography is the fact that I was a member of the International Anti-Apartheid Movement and for a short while, also of the African National Congress in South Africa. And in that capacity, I had the honor of working briefly with some great heroes of the struggle, like Makamara Maharaj, who helped draft South Africa's first truly democratic constitution. And, you know, I generally try to avoid the cliche of quoting his old prison mate, Nelson Mandela, in order to bolster my arguments, but I'll make an exception in this case. Among the many lessons that Mandela taught us was that, in his words, education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. Education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. So now more than ever, we need you to harness that transformative power before it's too late. Because we are not here to fear the future. We are here to shape it. So thank you very much.
Galvanising words there. Dr. Simon Adams, President and CEO of the Centre for Victims of Torture in New York, soon to be Professor of Human Rights at Murdoch University. back in Australia. Simon was speaking at the 2025 conference for the Australasian Council of Deans of Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities, or DASH, representing deans from almost every uni in Australia and New Zealand, and thanks to its organisers. We love hearing from you. What's your response? I know many of you work in universities. Email us, bigideas@abc.net.au. And let us know how you're responding to the big thinkers we bring you, or if you know of any great events coming up that you think we should get on the airwaves. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Great to have your company today. Back soon with more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.